And welcome to the Agile Revolution. This is Craig.
And this is Tony. And our guest, James Shaw.
Hey, James. How are you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. We're at Agile Australia 2015 in Sydney, and you've jetted all the way over from Portland, Oregon, is it?
Yeah, that's right. Greg? It's a bit of a flight.
And just completed the keynote for us this morning, which I must say we enjoyed greatly.
Oh, thank you.
So people, I mean, your work that you've been talking about here in the workshop, which I was really lucky to attend on Tuesday, was about the Agile Fluency Model. But I think I first came to know you through your book from, is it 7 or 8 years ago now, The Art of Software Development, and your related blog with a similar name.
Art of Agile Development.
Yes. Yes. But I say software development.
Yeah, you did. But, yeah. You know, Agile is software development these days. So. Mm.
So did you start with a real XP background? Is that where you sort of came from?
I did. I was a programmer, and I was involved with a team that I was leading a team, and we had chosen feature-driven development, and somebody on that team came to me and said, hey, let's do extreme programming. And I said, what? Extreme what? That's a terrible name, which it was, and still is. And they said, yeah, they're talking about it on Ward Cunningham's Portland Pattern Repository Wiki. And I said, the what? And but I checked it out, and it looked really interesting. But we were doing feature-driven development. But and the ideas looked really dumb. I mean, honestly, pair programming, testing, evolutionary, ridiculous. But I trusted the idea, the people behind the ideas, so I decided to try it, as I do with things that I think are ridiculous. And it worked really well. And so I got involved with doing extreme programming on my next project, and loved it, and couldn't find any more jobs doing extreme programming, so I had to start teaching people how to do it and leading them as a coach. And time went on, I wrote a book about it, and here we are.
It's interesting for us because it's a very similar journey for Craig and I.
Yeah, but I just want to take you back this way. You mentioned feature-driven development, which is an Australian invention. It's the only Jeff DeLuca.
I did not know that.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, it was one of the early, I guess it has a lot of agile connotations there, and still a lot of the practices that came from that are still of use, particularly more at programs at scale.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a vendor-based thing that got your organization into feature-driven development, or why did they go down that path? Because it's a non-waterfall path to a certain extent.
Yeah, well, before that, I was in a company. I was hired into a company that was building industrial robots, and at the time, I've always been into process and figuring out how to do software well, and at the time, I was following the software by the book, which the book was PhaseGate. It was Waterfall. And that company was doing it better than anybody else I had seen. So I was like, yes, we're going to do this. And to make a long story short, they did it better than anybody else I'd seen, and they failed harder than anybody else I'd ever seen, which made me really step back and reevaluate. It's like, okay, this doesn't work. And there was a book, I want to say it was by Peter Cooper. It's called Designing in Color. And it had a little chapter on feature-driven development. And I thought to myself, well, this looks interesting. It's talking about all the problems I saw, and let's try it. And so I was hired to lead as a consultant, as a contractor, really, at an operating system company that no longer really exists, to lead a project. And I chose feature-driven development because I'd had that experience with the waterfall method just not working at all. And I liked it. But extreme programming took those ideas even further and worked even better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember being excited about it in the late 90s, I think, when I first heard about it. I hadn't really heard of Scrum at that point and was looking to implement it. And then along came this extreme programming thing. And I never really did it because it just went to the side.
And everybody looked at us strangely, those guys up on level 7 doing that strange thing in the dark tunnel over there called XP.
They're in a cubicle. What
are they holding hands over?
You know, I learned something really important from feature-driven development. We did it pretty well. We worked in 1 month. Well, they weren't fixed-length iterations like they were in XP. But we shipped about every 3 weeks, 4 weeks. And we shipped exactly what the customer had asked for every time. And at the end of the project, they came to me one day and they said, we weren't paying adequate attention to the budget and we ran out of money and you're a contractor, so goodbye, because we have no more money. Well, you can stay, pointing to me, you can stay for 1 more week to train the person who's going to maintain the software. So that taught me, you know, pay attention to the financials. Yeah. But also, went to the key stakeholder afterwards. They brought me back later. They found the money. It hadn't run out. They just lost it. You know, these things happen.
Not quite worried by that at all.
So I can deal with comic with this.
Yeah, well, they brought me back. That's after I'd had a chance to try XP. So anyway, so the primary stakeholder came up to me and said, you know, everything's great. You've been showing us your progress, but we can't use it. I said, what? We're supposed to do the most important thing first. He said, no, well, we need security. And I said, we asked you about that. You said that was the least important. So that taught me really something really important, which is no matter how much you talk to your customer, they really don't know what they want until they, seeing is not enough. Mm. We actually, because it was sort of a hybrid method, we had a requirements document. We did a prototype, we put screenshots in there, we shared it to them. They don't really know how to describe what they want until they're using it. And that was a really valuable lesson for me, that and pay attention to where the money is.
Yeah, particularly as a contractor, right?
Right, right. Well, I think it for anybody, you know. I think Agile done really well is about producing results that you can talk about with financial people.
And yeah, it's not an easy conversation a lot of the times.
So. Yeah, and it's not our area of expertise, those of us who are programmers. So, or even come in from UX or DevOps, there's a lot of people on an Agile team don't have that kind of background, but having somebody on the team who has that kind of background is a really good idea.
So mentioning the book that then came along, so what was the desire behind that? I mean, because I think at the time I put that book up, and you signed my book for me, you saw the state of my copy of your book.
It's, well loved.
Dog-eared and the programmers pouring water on it. But I think at the time, there was the XP white book, mm-hmm. and then the subsequent not as good green book, in my opinion.
They're both good. They're just very different.
Yeah.
You have to read them both and understand that they're describing the exact same thing with a gap of about 7 years of experience.
Mm. That's interesting. That's what Dean Livingwell was saying today as well, when we talked to him about the different versions of his book.
Yeah.
Mm, people come to him and say, yeah, what about this, and this? And he goes, well, that was the book I wrote 20 years ago.
And, you know, I've written something else that says that's changed now. Yeah.
But I think actually in that particular book, was needed at its time, because it actually pulled together Scrum and XP concepts together, because you were either at that point doing Scrum or XP, and neither the twain shall meet. Mm-hmm. And I think that really put together a whole bunch of the concepts, and it holds up. You know,
still holds up. We still
extremely well now.
Still do a lot of those things now.
Yeah, every so often I look back through it and I think to myself, hey, the guy who wrote this knew what he was talking about. I wish I was that smart now. There's some things I would change. The stuff about customer testing hasn't stood the test of time, but quite a bit of it I'm still pretty happy with.
Mm. And it's all, is it all freely available, or certainly some large portions of it?
A lot of it I put up, because I wrote it to be something that could be used as a reference or read cover to cover. And so I put a lot of the individual practice pieces, not so much part three is not up, some of part one is not up, but part two, which is the bulk of the book and has all the individual practice information, I put that on my website in hopes that people would say, you know, if they're talking about pair programming or the planning game or refactoring, that they could just link to that site. And so I don't think I've ever told this to anybody before, but I've made a commitment to myself to keep those URLs live for the next 20 years. Okay. As long as I can, so that people, if they want to talk about these practices, they can just link to them.
And those URLs would be?
Well, they're on my website. My website is jamesshore.com. The book is at /agile-book, capital A, capital B, because I like making my life hard.
Excellent. And programmers are trying to link to it. Yeah.
But I can actually tell a lot of people who are putting a transformation through their organization, because a lot of people reinvent the wheel. I said, well, go and look at these resources here. It's actually one of the ones I certainly recommend.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of... So fast forward now.
Mm-hmm.
Today, some of the takeouts in today I really, really enjoyed was the levels of proficiency. That verbiage that you used there, I will take away with me today, because I think you said it. You know, it's not your crap. You're not proficient where we need you to be, and how do you get to those levels of proficiency? And you might get off at that bus stop, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think that was fantastic.
Thank you.
How did you come to that sort of conclusion? I'm interested in the thought process that got you there.
Well, I really need to call out my partner, Diana Larson, my business partner, Diana Larson, because it was her and I working together that created this model. And really, it came from procrastination. We were working on a course, which I still really love. It was a 5-day boot camp. The idea was to immerse people in Agile Done as well as we knew how. And over the course of 5 days, we could do it. And they were building real software and doing continuous integration. We had a network, cross-functional teams, you know, with programmers and testers and QA on the teams. And in the beginning of the course, we were teaching people basics of Agile planning. And so we started out and we would say, here's what task planning looks like, here's what story planning looks like, you know, release planning, and take it all the way out to product planning. And the feedback we'd get from people is, all right, so we understand the details of stories and so forth, but how does that fit into the big picture? We say, well, we're getting to that. But we kept getting that feedback, so we turned it around. We said, we'll start out with the big picture and then go down to stories. And so the feedback we started getting at the end of the first day was, okay, we see the big picture, but how does it really work? This was understandably frustrating. So we were talking about this and just thinking, how can we teach people how Agile works? And we were also distracted by Willem Larson's idea of language hunting, the idea that you can be fluent at multiple levels, or there are multiple levels of language proficiency, and you can be fluent at any one of them. And that, I think, is a really important insight, is that proficiency is good, but to really succeed with something, to be able to do it under pressure, you need fluency. And fluency at a low level of proficiency is just fine. It has a lot of value. So we decided to rebuild our course around this idea. And it worked amazingly. We got, you know, people were very pleased with the course. We stopped getting these annoying questions at the end of the first day, how does it all fit together? And we realized we were onto something. So we took it out and we looked at how does it fit into the bigger Agile picture. We took it to colleagues. We workshopped it at conferences, and we shared it with consultants and executives, and refined, and ended up, I think, with something that's not too bad. And for those of you who haven't heard of this, listening to this, it's you can find the white paper at agilefluency.com. It'll lead you to a paper on Martin Fowler's site where we sort of lay it all out.
You know, I would really suggest you have a read, because it's really worthwhile.
And I think the notion that we take away, to paraphrase what you were saying, is this idea is, firstly, it's not a maturity model, which is the biggest mistake that people make.
We have to say that over and over again, because anytime you see something that says, here's 1-star, 2-star, 3-star, and 4-star, people's first reaction is, well, if we're not 4-star, we're crap, right? And actually, for the vast majority of teams, 4-star is inappropriate. For most large enterprises, 3-star is inappropriate. It's about finding the right stop.
And that was it. I think it's that bus stop analogy, and I think the aha moment that a lot of us got in your workshop on Tuesday was, I think you got us to relate to where we were, and most of us come look for us, as particularly as Agile coaches in the room, yeah, our teams are kind of at level 3.
We're really 4. I mean, what's the highest number again?
and then you gave us number 1 and said, how many of your teams are there, and got us to rank it, and I think I pulled 1-5, a bunch of 4s, and even a couple of 3s, and then had to take it along and look at myself, and
there were a lot of depressed looking faces in the room at that moment. But it's a tool for understanding what the possibilities are. And for that reason, I'm really happy with it, because people are taking this model and seeing, hey, you know, there's more to Agile than we even realized. And now we can think about where we want to be and which of those possibilities are right for us.
I love the way, I think the thing that maybe I hadn't appreciated until sitting in there, because I've certainly looked at the model and I've spoken to Diana about it on previous occasions, I don't think I fully appreciated, firstly, how you've pulled out teams from software development. So, you know, star one is just working together and collaborating. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the slide you had where you related it to Scrum and Kanban. Mm-hmm. And then slide 2 is really those technical practices and making them sing, which, whilst you can be good at those at number one.
Mm-hmm. Well, the proficiencies come at different times for different teams.
Yeah. But really, to make them sing and to be able to then do things like continuous delivery and you know, some of those practices, you really need to be at that level 2, mm-hmm. To achieve those. And then level 3, which I think everybody maybe aspires to be, is then when you're taking all that to the next level, and particularly, as you said, in control of your own, I guess you control the business and control of the results and those type of things.
Yeah, and you can see some amazing results from that. I worked with a team, I mentioned this in the keynote, a company that I worked with that really wanted their teams to be 3-star. and dedicated the effort to hire product managers and to bring in expertise in their problem domain, which is flight statistics, and really put forth that effort. And I talked to them recently, their CTO, and he was telling me that one of their teams had identified that this is not something that anybody from the business side would have ever recognized. They said they realized that the key piece of software that they used, which cost them $40,000 a month in licensing fees, was something that they could replace. And so they took 2 weeks, just 2 weeks, to rewrite the software, and now they're saving that $40,000 every month. It's saving them hundreds of thousands a year. And that's the kind of thing you get from a team that's really at the high end of Agile, is bringing these ideas. You know, that takes business and technical together, and that's fantastic.
And there's nothing more joyous than working in a team like that.
It's fun.
It is.
It's,
you know, I've been blessed once in my career so far to work with a team like that. I could truly say that, and it was just a pleasure to come to work.
Yeah.
And that's a very rare thing when you see that with teams.
You know, in the early days of Agile, Brian Merrick talks about this. I like to call it Merrick's Missing Manifesto, because he has a great talk with four values that should have been in the Agile Manifesto. And they were skill, discipline, ease, and joy. And that's something that we saw in the early days of Agile, as people, you know, it was a grassroots movement. It was a lot of it was extreme programming and driven by programmers, feature-driven development and so forth. And the people on these teams, I mean, they were early adopters, they were enthusiastic, and they were seeing major changes in their work. I mean, you see this even with a two-star team. It doesn't have to be a three-star team. That ability to ship whenever and have that teamwork and that cohesion, it's just fun. And as Brian says, too many times you go into a place where they're doing Agile and they say, well, yeah, it's better than it used to be. At least my job doesn't suck as much anymore. But I want to see more of that joy. And there was a little bit of a subversiveness behind our design of the model for Diane and I. We wanted to see people just realize there's more to it than that my job doesn't suck as much anymore. There's that joy is possible.
What are you seeing? I mean, so at the keynote today was really an awareness, I think, for a lot of people, because a lot of people wouldn't have seen it before. What are you seeing now as you begin to, you know, continue to educate people or put this model in front of them? What's the uptake, and are you hearing stories about you know, what, people changing their organizations or their teams?
You know, it's still the early. We've had the model out for a while, so we're hearing a lot of people say this makes sense to us. You're not hearing a lot of stories about how people are using the model. That's sort of what we're doing now, is we're trying to take it out, and rather than just put the model out there, the workshop, for example, is teaching people how to use it to really to tailor their coaching to understand what the right level of fluency is for their team, how to talk to their senior managers and leadership about that, what that means in terms of organizational investments, because fluency, an insight that Diana had that I've really come to appreciate, is that fluency comes more from the organization's investments than from the team. So if you're not seeing the level of fluency you want in a team, look at the organization first. So we're definitely seeing people say that get a lot of value out of the model, say it makes a lot of sense for them. We see people, when they really truly understand the model, their face falls a little bit, because there is that sort of human desire to be 4-star, and then you realize what it takes to be 1-star, you know, to actually be working in terms of business stories, not technical stories. We tried to make these sort of a bright line, and that's a higher bar than people expect.
Did you expect that to be such a high bar? I mean, sometimes when you put these models together, you sometimes look at it and go, and on the one hand, maybe go, you know, like, hey, everybody should be there because you know, we're super coaches and we always get them there. Or on the flip side, did you purposely make it to be, you know, the bars to be reasonably high so that...
Well, what we did was we looked at what teams were actually doing, and we saw a lot of teams and our own experience with teams, and we could see that no matter how you started, you know, even if you're aiming for 3-star and putting in, trying to get the business expertise and working on continuous delivery and also working in terms of stories and business perspective, what we saw is that teams most often tend to get to fluency at the 1-star and then to the 2-star and then the 3-star. And we chose the stars mostly just to be a really clear and understandable bus stop along the way. Not the end of your journey, but a place at which, you know, you can see, yeah, this makes sense. So we chose 1-star because there are a lot of teams doing Scrum. And then we chose fluency, and there's a lot of proficiencies associated with that, doing stories well, working as a team, and so forth. And we tried to make fluency a bright line, not too low of a bar, because again, this is...
Because that's a pretty high bar to get to. I mean, a lot of people, I think as it's been tweeted, the t-shirt that someone's wearing, Scrum is hard, Scrum's easy, but it's hard to do whatever it says.
Yeah, Scrum is simple, but it's hard to do.
So a lot of people can go around saying, hey, I'm agile, but, or I'm doing Scrum.
And that was a big part of where the model came from, is we saw these people saying, oh, I'm agile, and there was arguments about, I'm agile, you're not agile, what does this mean? So the Agile Manifesto is fantastic because it lays out a philosophy. We wanted to be more concrete so that people could understand, exactly. They could have something they could look at and use as an aspirational goal. We will never certify people as being one-star team or, whatever. It's a team model, not an individual model. So I don't know how you'd certify in the first place. But that's not the purpose. The purpose is for people to be able to use it and look at themselves and say, hey, what are our opportunities? So it's aspirational. If we made it, we made the bar low, then there'd be nothing to aspire to. And one star isn't that hard once you know what you're looking for and when you have the support of the organization. We see people get to one star with dedicated effort in 2 to 6 weeks. We see people get to two star, again, with dedicated effort and mentorship, technical mentorship, in 3 to 9 months, sometimes more if there's a lot of technical debt, because two star you can ship on the market cadence, and when there's a lot of technical debt, that's harder. But I worked with a company that hadn't shipped anything for a year and a half, and they got to solid two star, I think they got there within about 9 months, with some good help. Arlo Belshi, a friend of mine, who's somewhat well known in the Agile community, helped them out, so they had a lot of really great help. Three star, that takes a lot longer. But so one star, it's a high bar, but it's a low bar.
I think one of the things that struck out to me, I certainly as a coach, my job is to take people past that, certainly at least one star and take them past it, but differentiating that the technical and teamwork practice is the interesting thing, and really calling the things that you need to do to be there as a...
Yeah, I think that's the thing I liked as much as a coach. It just gives you that motive of saying, well, here's the things I need to concentrate on to get them across that bar. Mm.
I do want to be clear, though, that we're not separating the technical practices, because I think one of the most important things in Agile is that we are creating cross-functional teams. So I'm not separating the technical practices when I say that the technical practices are needed for two-star fluency. Yeah. I'm just acknowledging the reality that a lot of teams start out without technical practices.
Yeah. Yes.
Again, the model reflects what we see in the real world. It's not what we wish would happen, but what really does
it's
happen.
It's real excellence in your technical practices as opposed to just good data practices.
So the other thing that I talk to them a lot about is we talk about cross-functional sticky teams. So when we talk about sticky teams, is keeping that same team together. The team that owns it is the team that supports it, the team that ships it, right? Because I've, and Craig's been there as well, I'm sure you have, is the worst thing is that particular team, I said it was a joy to come to work, right? We fell foul of the old, we formed, we normed, we stormed, and then we performed. And then the project broke up and we hit the last one. We mourned.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody went everywhere. Mm-hmm. And, it's funny, we still, those particular people from those teams, even though we've gone everywhere, we still have reunions. And it really is still, and it's 9 years since then, still a mourning. Well, we still mourn.
I've only had a few of those experiences in my career, and they're to be treasured. When you're on a team that really has normed and is performing, it's so much fun. There's so much energy and camaraderie. It's really fantastic. And one of the things, I don't think it's necessary for fluency, except that if you break teams up too quickly, it's hard to develop skills. But boy, if you've got that kind of high performance team, it's not wise.
No,
it's not the smartest thing you can do to break up a team like that. When you find them, keep them together. But what happens, you've probably seen this, is that when a team starts to norm, they get a little bit insular, they get kind of high and mighty, and we're better than everybody else. That can threaten the rest of the company. Yeah. And that's sometimes just when the team's on the cusp of being something great, they get broken up because they look weird and they look threatening to the rest of the organization.
Yeah, and they're pushing the edge. Because often when they get to be a high-performing team, they start to push the edge with the new things, right? Because they're looking you know, good's no longer good enough, you know. You know, right. Good's the enemy of great. So they started to push these little bars, and people are going, these guys are going too far now. Yeah. Yeah, we're afraid of that.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of success is really, I mean, I mentioned this in the keynote, it's not because Agile creates magic unicorns. It's not because there's anything, there's no magic fairy dust that makes Agile more productive. But Agile can be dramatically more productive than other teams. I talked about a study where just from creating a team and co-locating them, one group cut their time to market to 1/3. Mm. I don't think I said this in the keynote. They replicated that result with 8 more teams. And that's just because if you take out the silly things that organizations like to do, like breaking up a successful team or having people work on 5 projects simultaneously, or as another presentation I went to, having hot seating where everybody on your team can be, you know, across the building one day and on different floors the next. Stop doing those things, and you can see some amazing results. It's not because the people are better or smarter, it's just you're not getting in their way as much.
Yeah, so they've just finished a study, I think, on gaming. I don't know if you've seen this, called Gamer Sutra, where they went through and looked at all these things about, you know, because gaming is pretty, you know, lots of challenges there. And you actually look at the results they came with, because it's a pretty comprehensive study, and it pretty much, you can go through the manifesto and just knock the things out. As, yeah. we found that doing this didn't help, and we found that didn't help. But, you know, what was really there was actually all those things kind of helped along the way and were good, but it was just the simple, basic stuff that, you know, teams were doing and not doing the crazy stuff like you mentioned.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a really good thing to have a look at. So where's the fluency model going? So you've got it out there. People are, you know, talking about it. Where are you sort of trying to moving and evolving it to now?
Well, I think this is something we could continue to work on for years. I mean, there's questions about how does organizational fluency fit in? How does large-scale environments fit in, interdependent teams and so forth? And those are things that we're definitely interested in looking at in the future. Right now, I think we first put it out in 2011. It's proven at this point where people just tell us over and over, this makes sense, it matches my experiences. So now what we're trying to do is just get it out there in the world, especially for those larger organizations that have trouble understanding how to get out of the way of their teams. We really want to help them. So we're creating something called the Agile Fluency Diagnostic, which is a facilitated tool. So this is something for facilitators to use, coaches and so forth, to use with teams in an organization to help the teams understand where they're at and where they might want to be and how that fits in with the organization. And then a way of reporting that back to the organization that avoids management dysfunction and, you know, the behavior that can result from you must be 2-star. You know, part of it is just helping people understand that, you know, fluency comes from the organization more than the team, but a way of reporting it back. And also we're creating an organization ourselves, we haven't decided on the name yet, but to support Agile Fluency, where we are going to license this diagnostic out to people. We're going to start out making it very easy to get a hold of. And the condition, though, is going to be for people to share their data back to us, and then we will take that, we'll anonymize it, and we'll send it back. And so for large corporations especially, you know, having the ability to see how their teams compare to other people like them is something that we see a lot of demand for. And I think we have the opportunity to do it in an intellectually honest way that actually really helps teams grow in their understanding of Agile and be more successful as high-functioning teams.
It's also interesting to see over time, yeah, if that sort of is at the same teams, you know, go back and redo the data to see if there's a trend of the Agile community in general moving, even though it's not a maturity model, but seeing that, you know, we are getting more proficient in 2s and 3s perhaps, rather than just 1s.
Yeah, well, I think a big part of if this really takes off and we can do a good job of collecting data, there's opportunity for all kinds of very interesting data analysis to happen. I think one of the pieces of data we want to collect is what's the right level of fluency for your organization. So it's not, are you a high, you know, are you a 3-star or 4-star, which I said is inappropriate for almost everybody. It's not, are you 3-star? It's how many people are where they want to be and what kind of organizations want to be where and why, and how are people getting closer to where they want to be.
So I actually want to take you back to, I think, the best presentation I've ever seen you give, which was a few years ago in our, and it was called Bloody Stupid Johnson.
Yeah, that was with Arlo Bauschi, that I mentioned earlier.
Before.
Yeah.
So for those who haven't seen, it was essentially a role play on how, I guess, not to sell Agile into an organization, I guess, for want of a better term. And I still have my certificate at home. I can't remember what it's called now. You issued a certificate for Agile.
Yes, you were a certified Agile software specialist. For those of you following along at home, spell that out.
Yeah, I still have my certificate at home, and I was just afraid. I didn't get to wear the beer hat. That was the only.
We handed out. That was so much fun. I love working with Arlo. We've done a lot of stuff together. Those of you who haven't seen it, it was a 90-minute scripted farce where Arlo and I played 6 different characters, and basically tried to lampoon absolutely everybody in the Agile community. Alistair Coburn was sitting in the front row, and at one point we talked about certain things that are near and dear to his heart. He was just lying on the floor showing arrows shooting into his heart. We had a lot of fun with it. It was recorded, but the recording, I don't know if it's still available, and it didn't.
It's still on the Alliance.
Yeah, it would be on the Agile Alliance site.
Yeah. So, I think that was one of those things that I think I really liked, because it was replayed. It was actually rerun.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it was just some of those things where I think as a community we can actually, poke fun at ourselves and I think sometimes we focus on the wars and certainly this conference has been a bit of a safe versus anti-safe movement and Scrum and Kanban and all those type of things and XP and Scrum. But I really loved that because it was something where I think we could all just forget our differences for a moment and actually remember that we are all alike and we're sometimes as bad as the other things we're trying to replace if we're not too careful.
Yeah, that's one of the things we're trying to do with the fluency model. If you look at it closely, there's nothing in there about which method you're using.
Yes, I do notice it.
And it will work if you're using Kanban, it will work if you're using XP or Scrum or Safe. It's a way of looking at where you're at, right? Not how you do it, which was very important to us. So, the method wars, one of the strengths of Agile that, because of human nature, I think people try to pull back from, is that Agile is a 24-word statement of values.
That's all it is.
That's all it is.
It's nothing more, nothing less.
Which means that it is everything that fits in those values. So Kanban is Agile. Lean is Agile. Safe is Agile. Scrum is Agile. XP is Agile. DSDM, FDD. These can all be Agile as long as we keep those fundamental values of, humanizing and simplicity and focus on customer and all this stuff. I actually don't ever remember those 24 words. It's like individuals and interactions, and then.
You don't do enough training.
But those values, as long as we're remembering those values, you need a method. The values, people can't take values and learn from that. They need to have something concrete. But anybody can. We should take anybody who's wants to fit in with those values.
Yeah.
And some will be better than others for certain contexts.
And I think once it jumps the shark from being even from the point of view of being denigrative to the method, but denigrative to the people, I think that's where we as an Agile community are letting ourselves down.
Then we're not respecting individual and natural.
Well, we aren't, it's happened recently, and I think we're better than that. Or we should be better than that, and anyone who's listening, I challenge you to be better than that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
The other thing that just in your past I did want to talk about was you had a series of, I'm not sure what I call them podcasts, but your Let's Code series?
I was sitting, little history of this. Again, never share it with anybody else.
We ask the questions, and we can sit here and talk about the Agile Fluency Model, or I want to get to the heat of the matter.
This is not controversial, but I guess I come to Australia and all my inhibitions go away, right? Which, by the way, I love this country, and I love Sydney, so I was very happy to come here.
We're from Brisbane, so
you have to come to Queensland.
Oh, okay. Well,
it's
there
the
you go.
State, then. No.
I, speaking of a little bit of rivalry, I've heard about just a touch of rivalry between Sydney and Melbourne. Just a touch.
Yes.
Right, so I was at the Agile conference when it was at the big Agile conference in the U.S. when it was at Disney World in Florida. And I sat down, and I happened to be at the same table as Martin Fowler, and I said to him, I'm thinking about writing another book. I said, but it's a lot of work. And he said, you know what? Everybody's, you know, video is where it's at these days. It's like, huh. So I sort of that processed through my head, and I said, well, let me try something. So I did this little screencast called Let's Play TDD about doing test-driven development in Java, because I wanted to show sort of how it flows. And wow, people really liked it. So 3 years ago, I did a Kickstarter saying, let's do this, only it's going to be in JavaScript, and I'm asking you to pay for it so I can put a lot of effort into it. And it, you know, I got a fantastic response, and I built the screencast. And so, yeah, now I have a screencast that's still ongoing. We are up to episode 316. There's four channels. There's 316 episodes in one channel, and there's new episodes coming out all the time in the other channels as well. And it's called Let's Code JavaScript, and it's at letscodejavascript.com. And doing all kinds of neat stuff in there, if I may say so. The thing I'm most proud of that we've done lately is I've figured out how to do test-driven development of CSS.
Nice.
Yeah. It's open source. It's available now. If you go to GitHub/James Shore and look for the Quixote project, Quixote, like Don Quixote, because it's a CSS after all. you'll find it. And this is a tool that, unlike others, some CSS testing tools will take images, which is very fragile, and compare images. There's value in that, but it's fragile. Others will say, well, tell me what you plan on typing into the CSS, and I'll tell you if the problem, that's not useful. What this does is it lets you do unit testing, so you can say something like, I've got a page, and it has a nav bar, and the nav bar is exactly the width of the viewport. And inside the nav bar, on the right-hand side, inset 10 pixels, is a logo. And below the nav bar is a content area, and it's as wide as the viewport minus the width of the sidebar. So all about how things relate to each other and fit together on the page, so you can actually test drive your CSS, run it on multiple real browsers, Firefox, IE, and refactor your CSS.
Are you testing the boxes, or are you testing the display, or is it both?
Well, it's unit testing, so you do your setup. You either load in a real page and make assertions about that, which is more of an integration test, or you, if you're trying to create a reusable component, you just build the elements.
So you are testing by essentially testing the boxes and those type of things that the logo is really underneath the...
Yeah, in the DOM, there is a function called get bounded client rect? Something like that. I don't remember now. But it... Basically, the browser will tell you where everything is on the page. Mm. So I use that, and I fix all the cross-platform weirdnesses, and I present a nice API on it. So rather than saying, this is at pixel 362, you say, this relates to these other things in this way. And you get these beautiful error messages out. For example, something I did recently, I wanted my page to fit perfectly on the iPad. So I resized the window to be the same size as the iPad. I said the bottom element is 13 pixels above the bottom of the viewport. And it turned out that the way I'd done it is I made some cross-browser screw-ups. So the error I got back on IE9 was the bottom border of this element, of the join us button, is 2 pixels too high. It was, you know, 640 such and such, or we expected 600 such and such, which is the bottom border of the join us button, and it was actually 600 something two more. So
that's excellent.
Yeah. So finding that stuff early.
I'm sorry?
Finding that stuff early is really key.
Yeah, and I mean, it's really hard to refactor CSS. No. It's not safe. And I use Firefox as my primary browser. It's very easy for me to tell which sites have been developed on Chrome. Because they don't always show up quite right on Firefox. Mm. And there's just little differences, but they're noticeable. So you know, I'm sure they tested it cross browser originally, but of course they had to make some changes and they broke something, and it's, you know, it's not safe. So just like we need to be able to unit test the rest of our code, CSS is code too, we need to be able to test it so we can refactor it.
Man after my own heart. And I mean, that was a Kickstarter. You know, what's the model for that moving forward? Is it pay for the episode, or?
Well, the Quixote project that we were talking about, that's free. It's open source. I've been building a fair amount of stuff like that just as we go. The screencast itself is subscription based. The current price is $25 a month, and you sign up, you get access to everything, and you watch as much as you want, as little as you want. You stream it, you download it, it's DRM free, and then when you've gotten your fill, you can unsubscribe, and that's all there is to it. So
that's excellent. No, Greg. I think I'm dry of questions. I'm amazed that we.
I've got so many more I could ask, but you know, you're only in the country for a week, so it's been great catching up with you. If people want to find, firstly, more about the Agile Fluency model, where do they go?
That is at agilefluency.com. That's a short link. It will take you to the white paper we wrote that's on Martin Fowler's site. And you can
download the model and use it and print it and show it to your teams and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we know we've trademarked the term Agile Fluency just to prevent abuse, but the model itself is licensed for people to use in their presentations. However you want to use it, please take it. We've got a nice high-resolution PDF for you to grab. And that's at agilefluency.com.
Excellent. And if people just want to find you and everything you're up to, where's the best place for them to find you on the interwebs?
Well, my blog and the excerpts from the book are at jamesshore.com. Mm-hmm. And the screencast about JavaScript is at letscodejavascript.com. And we've just recently launched a how-to channel that's free. So it's for beginners, for people who are coming out of a code school and want to know how to do professional development.
Excellent. Awesome. Now, based on the STAR fluency model, mm-hmm. what STAR should I rate your keynote today?
Well, clearly that would be 4 stars. Yeah.
Sorry, I couldn't resist it.
That's aspirational for a keynote.
Right. Yeah. It was at the end of your keynote, I went to put the finger on the STAR and went, proficiency, fluency, which one should I press?
Well, I do want to say, at the risk of bringing it down, fluency model is not an individual model.
Yes, you're right.
Very good answer. It's been great having you at the conference, and it's always good to hear these things, I guess, from the people who created them, and thank you for all the things you have created in the community, because that's what allows the rest of us to continue to have the conversation and build even bigger and better things. So thank you for everything you've done.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for having me. It's been a delight and a pleasure.
Thank you greatly for just taking the time to spend with us and the guys who are listening.
So we have one last thing to do. We have a little thing at the end of the podcast.
It doesn't involve clothes.
I've already been through one hazing ritual. You know, there's the Tim Tam slam.
Are you all right? Your sugar level's okay?
they sort of went through the roof for a while, but I'm doing okay now.
So Tim Tam slam. So how do you explain a Tim Tam slam? You're going to go back to the States now, right? And your family or friends are going to say, what's this Tim Tam slam I read about on Twitter, because it's all over it.
Well, I'm going to say to them, you know how you take cocaine, you boil it in a spoon? That's crack. Well, now take chocolates and donuts and everything sweet at the supermarket and put it in a spoon and boil it down and then suck it through a straw, and that's the Tim Tam slam.
Pretty much close to it a little bit.
Well, at the end of the podcast, we always end our just by saying Viva la Revolution. So on the count of three, one, two, three.
Viva la Revolution!
Thank you.